Thanks, everybody.
No, thank you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Well, maybe.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California on KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding, KKRN in Round Mountain, and KGOE in Eureka. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, in Cottage Grove on Queso, in Eugene on KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you across the intertubes on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, amongst others, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around exhausted but swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. All right, we will get to all of that Michael Cohen stuff in a bit, in a moment here. But I want to say that I blame myself, Desi Doyen, for the 10% drop-off in Obamacare signups this year.
Aww.
It's my fault. I haven't mentioned the open enrollment period, I don't think once on this show, during the entire period for 2019, which, by the way, ends this Saturday, December 15. One of the ironies here is that because Republicans have not been trying to overtly kill it this year, the Affordable Care Act has received a lot less coverage in the media and, yes, on this program. So,
aha, I see what you're saying there. Without that being in the media all the time, people aren't hearing that the sign-up deadline is coming up.
That's it. The open enrollment is going on right now for very affordable health care coverage if you need it, including government subsidies to cover them. In the majority of cases, and because of the lack of controversy, people don't know that the 2019 enrollment period ends on December 15. Now, to be fair, we have been kind of busy around here with, you know, the still ongoing midterm elections, and we've got some news on that too coming up today. Some new news, but still, I blame me for the drop-off in sign-offs. We will be joined by Politico's Alice Olstein to discuss the reasons for the drop-off in sign-ups, other than my lack of discussion about it here on the show.
Okay.
As well as what Democrats can and or will do to try and protect the Affordable Care Act once they take control of the majority in the U.S. House after the turn of the year. Now, so that's coming up. Now, as you know, I don't make predictions. They are for suckers. But I gotta say, two different stories today lead me to almost say out loud that Donald Trump is now cooked. But I won't say that out loud.
Okay.
Because I don't do predictions. But even though he sure does look cooked at this point, I got to say, one way or another, mark today down, Desi Doyen, as the day that I did not say that Donald Trump is cooked.
Okay.
According to AP, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's once devoted lawyer and all-around fixer, was sentenced on Wednesday to 3 years in prison after telling a federal judge that his, quote, blind loyalty to Trump led him to cover up the president's, quote, dirty deeds. Standing alone at the defense table, Cohen shook his head slightly and closed his eyes as the judge pronounced the sentence for crimes that included lying about his boss's business dealings in Russia and funneling hush money to two women who said they had sex with Trump, payments that both Cohen and federal prosecutors said were made at Donald Trump's direction. U.S. District Judge William Pauley said Cohen deserved modest credit for his decision over the summer to admit guilt and cooperate in the federal investigation of efforts by Russians to influence the 2016 presidential election, but that Cohen's assistance, quote, does not wipe the slate clean. The judge also ordered Cohen to pay $1.39 million in restitution, to forfeit another $500,000, and to pay about $100,000 in fines. So all told, some $2 million Michael Cohen is going to have to cough up at this point. And remember, this is a guy that cooperated with federal investigators. He gets 3 years in jail. He's got to pay $2 million. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team said that he has been very helpful in their probe, while federal prosecutors separately in New York's Southern District said that Cohen was not fully forthcoming, and so he deserved substantial jail time. At the sentencing hearing, a prosecutor in Mueller's office said that Cohen has, quote, sought to tell us the truth, and that is one of the utmost That is of the utmost value to us and has, quote, provided consistent and credible information about core Russia-related issues under investigation. She did not, however, elaborate on that that help that he is providing to their Russia-related probe. Similarly, in a filing from Michael Flynn's lawyer, on Tuesday, the former national security advisor on Tuesday night, as part of his sentencing, where he has pled both guilty and has also cooperated with Mueller's probe, Flynn again admitted that he lied to FBI investigators about his conversations with Russian officials. But that filing also fails to explain why he lied about what would otherwise not likely have been illegal at all. They had been elected. Donald Trump had been elected president. Flynn was set to be his national security advisor. There was really nothing wrong with talking to someone, in this case, the U.S. ambassador from Russia. So the mystery of why Flynn and the rest of Team Trump kept covering up their contacts with Russia, with, you know, people affiliated with Russia, that continues to be perhaps the largest central mystery in this entire affair. But as to Cohen and the hush money payoffs made to a porn star and a Playboy model at Trump's direction, if the guy who acted on Trump's direction to violate campaign finance laws to hide sexual affairs with two women, but who cooperated substantially, if not fully, with federal prosecutors, if he is getting 3 years in jail and has to cough up $2 million, imagine what the guy who actually directed that criminal conspiracy could get at this point. That guy, of course, being Donald Trump. In a court filing last week, the prosecutors left no doubt that they believe that Cohen arranged the hush money payments at Trump's direction, saying that the maneuver was part of an effort to, quote, influence the election from the shadows. Cohen, who once boasted that he would take a bullet for Trump, told the judges before the sentence came down that, quote, it was my own weakness and blind loyalty to this man that led me to choose a path of darkness over light. Time and again, I thought it was my duty to cover up his dirty deeds rather than listen to my voice. Cohen got choked up several times near the end of his remarks to the judge. He had pleaded guilty back in August to evading $1.5 million in taxes related to his personal businesses. In the part of the case with greater political repercussions, he also admitted breaking campaign finance laws in arranging payments in the waning days of the 2016 election to porn star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Last month, Cohn also pleaded guilty to lying to Congress by concealing that he was negotiating a proposal to build a Trump skyscraper in Moscow deep into the presidential campaign season. He said he lied out of devotion to Trump, who had insisted repeatedly during the campaign and afterwards that he had no business ties whatsoever to Russia. Beyond the guilty pleas, it is unclear exactly what Cohn told prosecutors, and it remains to be seen how much damage Cohn's cooperation will do to Trump. Cohn said in court that he will continue cooperating with federal investigators. And again, we still don't know what is at the heart of the Russia-related allegations here and why it is that everyone lies about them. I mean, including, by the way, the recent admission that we now know that Trump was still attempting to work out a deal with Russia in some fashion for a Trump Tower in Moscow much, much later into the election, into the campaign than we knew. That's not in and of itself illegal. Now, yes, they would have to change the sanctions against Russia in order for that deal to move forward. But in and of itself, I don't believe that it is illegal. So it's still very strange. There's still a whole lot about this that we don't know in regard to Russia and why everybody kept lying about it and continues lying about it. But for now, setting the Russia thing aside, back to the campaign finance fraud scandal here. Trump has denied any sexual relationship with the two women in question and argued on Twitter earlier this week in a tweet that misspelled smoking gun twice, not just once, but twice. He called it smocking gun. So it wasn't right. A typo because he did it twice. He just doesn't know how to spell smoking, apparently. So he said in those tweets that the payments to the women were, quote, a simple private transaction, not a campaign contribution, and that if it was a prohibited contribution, Trump said Cohen is the one, not him, who should be held responsible for it. His tweet said, "Lawyer's liability if he made a mistake, not me." He added, "Cohen is just trying to get his sentence reduced. Witch hunt."
And he just completely waves away like it never happened, that he used to claim that none of this had happened.
That none of it had happened. But now he still says, by the way, that I think he says that it didn't happen. But even though it didn't happen, that wouldn't stop them from going out and claim that it happened. Therefore, he had to pay them this money. Now, he didn't. He paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels.
Right.
But it was the National Enquirer who paid $150,000 to Karen McDougal to keep her quiet. So the sentencing today with Michael Cohn, that is not all. Separately, as the Washington Post notes late today, New York prosecutors, again, this is not Robert Mueller, but this is the special, this is the federal prosecutors in the New York
Southern District,
right? They announced on Wednesday that they had struck a non-prosecution agreement with AMI. That is the company that publishes the National Enquirer, and that they would not be prosecuting AMI for its role in squelching stories of women, according to the Washington Post, women who said they had relationships with Trump. AMI paid $150,000 to one of the women before the 2016 election. As part of the agreement, AMI admitted it made the payment principally, quote, in concert with Trump's campaign to, quote, suppress the women's story so as to prevent it from influencing the election, unquote. That, according to a statement from the Southern District of New York Prosecutor's Office. So, yes, National Enquirer's publisher and longtime Trump buddy David Pecker is now officially cooperating with federal prosecutors in their case against Donald Trump. As Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent explain at the Post, this delivers a serious blow to one of Trump's primary arguments in his own defense that the payoffs were merely a, quote, private transaction. That they weren't, you know, had nothing to do with the campaign. This was a private transaction. He can give money to whoever he wants. But as Waldman and Sargent note, after all, pretty much everyone in this caper, first Cohen and now the company that killed the stories in the question, has now publicly admitted that the payments were for the precise purpose of helping Trump win the election. In other words, for a public, not a private, a public purpose. It wasn't a private transaction. These were public transactions. This is precisely what makes the whole arrangement criminal. They note, because these payments were about getting Trump elected. Therefore, they were campaign contributions, which means they're limited and must be disclosed by law. They were not disclosed. They note, pretty much the only person who has not yet admitted that this was their purpose is Donald Trump himself. So, Trump, as I said, is cooked. Even without all of the potential Russia stuff and the obstruction of justice stuff that could still come down the road, any other president with just this, with just the payoffs to women right before the election, women with whom he was having an affair, I mean, as far as we know, Bill Clinton did not pay off any of the women with whom he was alleged to have had affairs. Arguably, you could say that was a private matter. But here, if he paid money to affect an election, that's a different story. And any other president with just that on his record at this point, it seems to me, would likely have resigned in disgrace by now.
Oh, indeed.
But of course, surrounding all of this for Cohn, for Flynn, for Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who agreed to cooperate with prosecutors but then didn't and instead shared what he learned about the probe, apparently with Trump and his team, reportedly. And of course, for Trump and his family and any other goons caught up in all of this, there is always the possibility of a presidential pardon. And that Trump could grant with a stroke of his pen, perhaps, even though it's never been done or tested in court, he could perhaps even pardon himself in all of these matters. He could get all of these people off the federal hook with a stroke of his pardon pen at virtually any time. And of course, he could remain shielded from federal criminal prosecution under the similarly untested argument, the premise that a sitting president cannot be indicted while in office. So, yes, while it seems like he's cooked, there are a few ways that he could skate from all of this. That, however, his pardon power and his power to theoretically not be indicted as president, none of that shields him or his businesses or his business associates or his family from a criminal prosecution by a state prosecutor. And today we learn that the one who has just been elected to that role in the state of New York is gunning for all of the above. New York Attorney General-elect Letitia James says that she plans to launch sweeping investigations into President Donald Trump, his family, and, quote, anyone in his circle who may have violated the law when she settles into her new job next month. We will use every area of the law to investigate President Trump and his business transactions and that of his family as well, James told NBC News in her first extensive interview since she was elected last month. Some of the probes that she intends to pursue with regard to the president, his businesses, and his family members include any potential illegalities involving Trump's real estate holdings in New York. Yeah, I'm sure there's no dirty business there. This was actually highlighted by a New York Times investigation published in October into the president's finances, which detailed all kinds of dirty businesses and blatant tax avoidance schemes on tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, that epic New York Times investigation into so much tax fraud and evasion from the Trump family, the Trump organization, the Trump Foundation, all of that feels like it was about 16 years ago.
It just disappeared.
Right.
It was a huge article. It just disappeared. Well, it didn't disappear as far as the New York AG-elect is concerned. She's also going to look into the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with a Russian official, which the feds are also investigating. But should Trump pardon himself or those involved in it, if any criminal action took place, a state prosecutor in the state where the meeting took place could also pursue that very same matter. She promises to examine government subsidies that Trump has received, which were also the subject of that Times investigative piece, whether he is in violation of the Emoluments Clause in the U.S. Constitution through his New York businesses. There are already several cases challenging that in, I think, Maryland and D.C., as I recall. So add New York to the potential list. She will continue to probe the Trump Foundation, which is already facing legal charges from the current outgoing New York Attorney General, just in case you thought that the new one had any intentions, the new one that's coming in, that she had any intentions of letting that go. Clearly, she doesn't. James said, "We want to investigate anyone in his orbit who has, in fact, violated the law." She campaigned on passing a bill to change New York's double jeopardy laws with an eye on possible pardons coming out of the White House. She wants to be able to pursue state charges against anyone that the president ends up pardoning in federal charges, because under current New York law, she might not be able to do that. So she's hoping that within the first 100 days that this bill to do away with that double jeopardy clause in New York, that bill will be passed. She says it is a priority because I have concerns with respect to the possibility that this administration might pardon some individuals who might face some criminal charges, but I do not want to let them be immune from state charges. She's enlisting, reportedly here, some heavy hitters as part of her transition here to help her identify important hires for her office, with an eye on bringing experts in who can look at Trump-related investigations. Of course, New York is also the home to the Trump Organization, where the presidential campaign was headquartered and his reelection campaign currently headquartered as well. It's where a number of the key events took place that Mueller is looking at. So all of this falls within James's jurisdiction. See why I'm starting to say this guy looks like he may be cooked? She's coming in very shortly, in just a matter of weeks, and she's going to continue, as I said, with the Trump Foundation investigation, which has been accused of engaging in illegal political coordination with the Trump campaign, with self-dealing, with violating legal ethics. So NBC notes the White House, Trump Organization, and attorney representing the company and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani did not respond to requests for comments.
Gee, I wonder why.
Exactly. They must be busy. So for her part, by the way, James thinks that Mueller is doing an excellent job. She says she thinks he's closing in on this president and that his days are going to be coming to an end shortly. We'll see. You know what else is coming to an end shortly? This year's Affordable Care Act open enrollment period.
I see what you did there.
See what I did there? We will talk about that and why drop-offs in sign-ups are down this year, and what the Democrats plan to do to protect Obamacare once they take majority control of the U.S. House in January. That's with Alice Olstein next. And then also coming to an end shortly, I suspect, is the mystery of whether or not there will be a new election called in North Carolina's 9th U.S. House District amid the ongoing GOP election fraud scandal there. Some new details now out on that today also suggest there is only one way that that question, that mystery, can go. All of that is still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Aren't you glad you came? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Late last month, in an article headlined, Trump may finally be undermining Obamacare, Politico's Paul Demko reported that there has been a steep drop in Obamacare insurance numbers halfway through the sign-up season for 2019, raising concerns that the Trump administration's controversial policy changes are undermining the marketplaces. The 9.2% drop to roughly 100,000 sign-ups per day has surprised some close observers of the Obamacare markets, who expected the number of customers to remain fairly stable even after Republicans eliminated the unpopular individual mandate penalties for being uninsured. Premium hikes were fairly low in most states for 2019, and many parts of the country saw an increase in consumer choice as more health plans participated in what they now see as a more profitable, stabilizing market. They note that a slow start, however, doesn't necessarily mean a slow end to the six-week season. As Demko cautioned at the time, a flood of signups could arrive as the deadline prods the inevitable procrastinators to act, but Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare backers, are concerned. Enrollment nationwide peaked in 2016 at 12.7 million signups, according to Kaiser, and has ticked down each year since then, with 11.8 million signups for the current year, at least as of the end of November. The Trump administration's shortened period for ACA open enrollment nears its end this weekend on Saturday, December 15, to be specific. That's the last chance for Americans to sign up or change plans for 2019 on the healthcare.gov site, which serves some 39 states which opted not to create their own state-run exchanges. But last week, with the with that December 15 deadline quickly coming, an update from the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees ACA signups, found healthcare.gov signups were down by almost 10% compared to last year, with just 3.2 million people enrolled through healthcare.gov this year versus 3.6 million at this same point last year. Barring a major turnaround in the final few days of open enrollment, Obamacare signups are on pace to be the lowest since 2013 and 2014, the first year of the exchanges, when the enrollment period was at least twice as long as it is now under the Trump administration's new restrictions. The reasons for the slowdown, however, are many, and all of them are not necessarily bad news for the program. Insurance experts say it's unlikely that any one major cause is behind the enrollment dip compared with last year's period. Instead, it's likely a confluence of headwinds, they say. At the same time, following the blue tsunami that swamped the midterm polls and elected at least 40 new Democrats to the U.S. House while leaving a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, the question is now, what, if anything, can Democrats do to protect Obamacare from further degradation by Republicans and the Trump administration? As Alice Olstein and Adam Sankren observe at Politico recently, House Democrats who swept back into power on the promise to protect people with pre-existing conditions face tough legal and political choices as they try to make good on that vow. Those promises galvanized millions of voters, they write. But now, like the Republicans previously elected on promises to repeal and replace Obamacare, Democrats face the formidable challenge of turning campaign rhetoric into reality. So, what has led to the drop-off in enrollments this year, and what exactly can a Democratic majority in the House, if not the Senate or control of the White House, what can they actually do to protect the landmark health care law that has ensured tens of millions of Americans since its passage under Democratic majorities in the House and Senate during the Obama administration? Let's ask Alice. Alice Olstein, formerly at Talking Points Memo, now a reporter at Politico, where she covers national politics, Congress, the administration, and all the dysfunctional hell that comes along with it these days, joins us once again here on the broadcast. Alice Olstein, great to have you back.
Thanks so much.
You report that the slowdown in the ACA signups this year does not appear to be due to any one reason, but rather a combination of many, not all of them even bad news. But I know with the midterm elections this year and the Republicans not actively trying to kill Obamacare, at least in Congress, there has been little discussion at all that the open enrollment period is even going on and that the deadline is coming up Saturday, December 15. What's the main cause that you chalk up this downturn to, based on your reporting?
Well, like you said, there's so many factors and so many changes that happened at once that it's impossible to attribute this percent of the drop-off to this factor, like the repeal of the individual mandate. People don't have to buy insurance if they want to avoid a penalty, and the new deadline and the lack of information and the lack of discussion in the news. But I think we're seeing some polling that just the widespread ignorance and misinformation about open enrollment is just a key contributor. There was a Kaiser poll recently that found that 75% of Americans do not know when the deadline is. It's this Saturday, as we said. And nearly one-third of people polled said they'd seen no information about how to sign up. And so under the Obama administration, the government invested $100 million in the outreach budget to put on TV ads and social media campaigns and in-person enrollment events to really gin up attention and get people to sign up. And the Trump administration cut that outreach budget by 90%. And cut the enrollment assistance budget by more than half. So I think we're seeing the effect of this. And I, lawmakers in Congress are, of course, very split on where to point the finger for this. And so you're seeing Democrats talking about the Trump administration's policies, what they call sabotage of open enrollment, cutting the outreach budget, cutting the length of open enrollment, cutting the enrollment assistance. And you're seeing Republicans say, oh, no, it's just because plans are too expensive, people can't afford them, that's why people aren't signing up.
Well, they went up a lot more last year than they did this year when they seemed to be sort of stabilized. They increased as healthcare costs always do, it seems, but not the kind of big bump in the increase in premiums that we saw last year. And so that alone, despite what the Republicans say, that couldn't explain it. It does seem to be. And I got to say, Alice, I feel bad. I feel terrible. You and I, we may have talked two or three times before and during the open enrollment period last year. I haven't talked about it at all on this show.
There's been a lot of other things going on.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that the midterm election came just days after open enrollment started just completely sucked a lot of attention away from this, and we didn't have that last year, obviously. And, you know, now we're staring down a government shutdown. So, really, I mean, it's in part due to there being just so much else drowning it out. But I think another key piece of data showing that it's not high prices that are deterring people is that when you look at the enrollment, drop-off is about 10%. But if you look at the drop-off of who's even coming to healthcare.gov to even check out what their options are, that's dropped off by a lot more, almost double. So people aren't even coming in the first place to see what to shop around, to look at different plans. And so I think that is an indication that it's more the lack of awareness than the cost.
And if you compare it to your colleague Paul Demko at Politico notes that the states who are running their own exchanges, so not the healthcare.gov numbers, but covered California out here, out in New York, where they run their own exchange, they are seeing no similar dip. For example, late last month, he reports enrollment in New York State is trending about 10% ahead of last year's numbers, and those numbers come despite an 8.6% rise in average individual insurance prices. That also undermines the Republican claim that it's because of the rise in healthcare.
Yes, and also I think another claim that's worth putting a little skeptical lens on is the claim that fewer people are signing up because the economy is doing so well and unemployment is down, and all of these people must have gotten nice jobs with health insurance, and that's why they're not signing up on the exchanges. I'm sure that accounts for some of it, but I think the drop-off is so large that it's worth questioning just how many people are in that situation, particularly because some of the highest job growth we've seen is in some of these, you know, gig economy, part-time, contract jobs that do not offer health insurance.
There is another, let's say, not terrible reason potentially for this, which is the expansion of Medicaid in a number of states. Like in Virginia, there has been more than 117,000 signups for the state's long overdue Medicaid expansion this year, following the blue wave in Virginia last year in their off-term elections. People signing up for Medicaid, are they not included in the CMSHealthcare.gov numbers? And could that be eating into new enrollments this year?
Well, they are no longer on private insurance. So, yes. Right, and we will see that happen in Maine later this year, again, because of the election results. I think that the drop-off we're seeing is so large that none of these things by themselves can really account for it.
With a drop-off this large, has any of this led to the talk that we had heard a lot in previous years of the dreaded so-called death spiral that would supposedly occur if there are not enough sign-ups, leading companies to pull out of the exchanges, drive up prices, and ultimately kill the ACA marketplace viability entirely? Is that a concern among providers now?
It's really not. I mean, we, like you said, have seen the market stabilize a lot. Insurers are profiting a great deal. And really, the drop-off, while it is significant, it is not the death spiral that was feared a few years ago, because you're still seeing millions of people sign up, and you're seeing people, you know, getting subsidies, and you're seeing insurers even entering new markets that they weren't in before, so you have more choices. So yes, we're not seeing the death spiral that was predicted.
You and Adam Sankren over at Politico recently pressed Democrats on what they now plan to do to try and protect Obamacare as they take their big majority in the U.S. House this year. There's only so much, of course, they can do while controlling just one chamber of Congress. But the big debate now appears to be on where to focus limited resources, whether it's to defend against this ongoing lawsuit against Obamacare filed by Texas and several other Republican states, or otherwise pass legislation to ensure the program's current protection for people with pre-existing conditions. Are those the essentially the two options that Democrats are trying to figure out where to move?
Well, I think there's a lot of focus on what the House can do on its own without having to ask the Republican Senate to collaborate, given the unlikelihood of that. So there are real serious talks about intervening in the lawsuit that is seeking to strike down the Affordable Care Act. And that is both important symbolically to show, hey, we're going to get in court and fight for your health care, but it's also important in a substantive way, because this entire lawsuit hinges on, what did Congress intend? Did Congress intend the Affordable Care Act to survive without the individual mandate? And the House's top counsel can go argue, yes, we did. We debated repealing the entire thing many, many, many times and chose not to. So we clearly intended to just get rid of the individual mandate and keep the rest. So that
lawsuit, just to clarify, that lawsuit is essentially saying that because the individual mandate is now dead, then you have to kill the rest of the Affordable Care Act as well? Is that essentially the argument?
Yes, and this is a lawsuit brought by a group of Republican attorneys general arguing in federal court, and the Trump administration sided with them in part and decided not to defend a law that's still on the books, which is highly unusual. But they're not arguing for the entire Affordable Care Act to be struck down. They're just arguing for some of the patient protections, like for pre-existing conditions, to be struck down. So that ruling could be handed down at any moment, although it will probably spend months, if not years, working its way up through the courts.
Who's defending it now, if not the Democrats are talking about somehow spending money? And I don't even know, do they have the right in Congress, in the House, hire someone to defend it? Who's defending it now?
Well, currently it is Democratic attorneys general defending it now, led by California. And they are the main folks defending in the lawsuit. And this would authorize the House counsel. So someone, you know, you don't have to hire someone. They have a whole office already there.
Okay.
To argue, the House's position on this. So that's something they could do. They don't even have to pass a formal bill, just a resolution. So that's sort of a low-hanging fruit. The other thing the House can do on its own is conduct oversight. So haul Trump administration and HHS folks to Capitol Hill and grill them on some of these key healthcare decisions. And we've been writing a lot about what are sort of the top things they hope to find out through that.
Democrats ran very hard across the country in the midterms on protections for pre-existing conditions. They put a lot of Republicans on the defensive on that score. Even the White House had to claim that they, not the Democrats, would protect coverage for pre-existing conditions. So great. Isn't this a great chance to call their bluff, to essentially push for the both push for the campaign promise by Democrats and force the GOP hand on this matter in advance of 2020, even if they can't pass it in both chambers? Wouldn't they be wise to push that and call Republicans on the carpet on this issue?
Well, there's a lot of desire to do that, of course. But there are a lot of potential pitfalls and things that Democratic lawmakers are worried about in pursuing those goals. So, one, the lawsuit and a ruling from a judge is just a giant unknown looming over all of this. We have no idea what the judge is going to do, if the judge is going to strike down the entire Affordable Care Act, just part of it, if he's going to stay the impact of the ruling until an appeals court weighs in. We just have no idea. And so, for instance, it would be pretty risky for the House to pass like a freestanding Protect Pre-Existing Conditions bill, and then so they pass it, and it's hard for Republicans to vote against that, obviously, just that by itself. But what if the judge strikes down more than just pre-existing conditions? Then you're abandoning those other pieces of the Affordable Care Act, leaving them without any protection. Mm. It also, if a ruling hasn't come down yet, or if the judge stays the impact, or doesn't immediately strike these things down, passing a pre-existing conditions bill could send a really confusing message, because pre-existing conditions are already protected under the Affordable Care Act. So to vote to protect them sort of undermines the idea that, hey, this law is the law of the land and we're going to stand by it. So there's just a lot of unknowns and a lot of concern, and that's why there are legal experts who we've quoted in our reporting who say focusing on the lawsuit and fighting that in court is the best way to protect pre-existing conditions, although it doesn't have the political advantage of putting Republicans in the hot seat.
Yeah, it's fascinating. In other words, if they do adopt or pass a bill that protects pre-existing conditions, that would also give the courts a little bit more ease to say, okay, well, we can find in favor of the Republicans, kill the Affordable Care Act's protection of pre-existing conditions because, look, there's this other law where they're still protected.
Right.
Very interesting. So have Democrats now at this point coalesced around any particular strategy as they move towards January, or is it the Dems, as the media like to say, disarray as they try to figure out how to move in January at this point?
Well, like I said, whatever comes out of the court will dictate a lot of their healthcare agenda, but there are definite plans to use oversight aggressively to, for instance, force the administration to say why they decided not to defend the Affordable Care Act in court, or force the administration to hand over documents for why they moved to implement all of these Medicaid work requirements that are causing a lot of people to lose their insurance. So there's a lot they can do on oversight, and like I said, there is a lot of support for intervening in the lawsuit. Beyond that, there's support for undoing some of the open enrollment cuts and cutbacks that have happened, although that is more about the House sort of showing what it's for because those things are not likely to make it through the Republican Senate.
Mm. So it's a lot of oversight and, well, I guess we just have to wait to see what happens at this point with that case. But even if the worst happens in that case, it will still be appealed. It will still take a while before we have any conclusion as to whether Obamacare, the key elements, will be struck down by that kind of crazy lawsuit.
Yes, and it's important to note that even folks who have been involved in challenging the Affordable Care Act in court in previous years, even all the way up to the Supreme Court, even they say that this case is frivolous and ridiculous and should be thrown out. So we don't know. The judge in Texas that is hearing it right now and could make a decision at any moment, he has been vocally hostile to the Affordable Care Act in the past, but that doesn't mean this will fly at higher courts.
So, okay, so we can rest a little bit easier that Obamacare is not going away anytime soon, and particularly with the Democrats now controlling the House. But I guess we can't rest. I wonder if we'll ever be able to rest easy. You know, if they're still fighting Medicare and Medicaid decades later, I suspect the fight against the ACA is also going to continue for decades, whether we like it or not. Well, whether we like it or not, Alice Olstein will hopefully be there to cover it. Alice Olstein, formerly at Talking Points Memo, now at Politico.com, where you can find her work. You can also find her on the Twitters at Alice Olstein. Great checking in with you, Alice. I suspect we'll be talking again soon once this court case comes down.
Sure, anytime.
Thanks, Alice. Once again, a reminder, since I have been deficient in that regard, the open enrollment period closes on the federal healthcare.gov exchange on Saturday, December 15th. Okay, new news out of the GOP election fraud scandal in North Carolina, and it does not look good for the GOP, not by a long shot. That story is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The North Carolina Republican Party said on Tuesday, this is the North Carolina Republican Party, said that a new election should be held in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District if a new allegation regarding the leak of early voting results before Election Day, before the November 6th election day, is proven. The results of the race between Republican Mark Harris and Democrat Dan McCready have already been held up over allegations of GOP election fraud against a contractor for one of Harris's campaign consultants. But as we reported on yesterday's broadcast, the state Democratic Party has highlighted another incident in the inquiry into the U.S. House race, releasing a signed affidavit from a Bladen County, North Carolina poll worker alleging that the results of early votes were tabulated and improperly shared before the election. That's a violation of the law. North Carolina Republican Party Chair Robin Hayes released a statement saying that if these allegations were true, they alone would be cause to hold a new election. In his statement, and you may want to sit down or hold on to something for this, Desi.
Okay.
Hayes said in the statement, quote, "This action by election officials would be a fundamental violation of the sense of fair play, honesty, and integrity that the Republican Party stands for."
Okay.
Yes, that's what
he met the Republican
that's
Party?
That's what he actually said, yeah. The people involved in this must be held accountable, he said in the statement, and should it be true, this fact alone would require a new election. That coming from a statement from the North Carolina Republican Party, and now we know that it is in fact true. We know in fact that they did print out they did tabulate the early vote totals in Bladen County. I guess the question is whether or not that information was shared outside of with anyone else other than, you know, election workers. Dallas Woodhouse, the executive director of the state Republican Party, said that it was likely, in fact, that early votes were leaked. He said, "We're almost sure those early votes were leaked out." Well, how is he so sure about that, Mr.
Yeah.
Woodhouse?
Hmm.
He told Politico, "We're almost sure the early vote totals were leaked. That's where we are. The state elections board has got to do whatever it does." So the state GOP is now all but conceding that a new election at a minimum is required here. But a new primary election may be needed as well as a new general election, since the absentee ballot fraud scheme at the heart of this matter also appears to have been carried out by Mark Harris's contractor during the GOP primary that unseated the incumbent Republican Robert Pittenger as well. So not just a new election. It seems like a new primary election is called for, really, at a minimum. But moreover, the state election board could also decide to simply toss out the absentee ballots in question here from Bladen County and award the election, if they want, to the Democrat, Dan McCready. So at this point, a new election with the same candidates is looking like the best case scenario for Republicans, it seems to me, at this point. In a press conference Tuesday afternoon, Woodhouse, again the executive director of the GOP in the state, echoed the call for a new election to be held if the allegations about early vote totals being leaked, if that proved to be true, and said that the state board of elections needed to take over any special election. He also defended the Republican Mark Harris here. Woodhouse said, "We have seen nothing that makes us think Mark Harris participated or would condone this behavior. We believe it is against his character." Also, it would be a fundamental violation of the sense of fair play, honesty, and integrity that the Republican Party stands for. Dallas, this is the character, McCray Dallas, independent contractor who was hired by the Harris campaign to do their absentee ballot operation in Bladen County, North Carolina, said Dallas reportedly oversaw this operation that collected absentee ballots from voters before submitting them or potentially not submitting them, we don't know, or allegedly changing them before submitting them, because we've got several affidavits saying that he was people collected ballots that were not where the envelope was not sealed and where the voter had not signed it, all of which is against the law in the state. Collecting the ballots is against the law, and certainly changing them and so forth is against the law, and certainly withholding them from being submitted is obviously against the law. That activity also took place in Bladen County, the same place where these early results were printed out and maybe leaked. And it's also where the local sheriff, who was also up for election and reportedly won, where that local sheriff, a guy by the name of Jim McVicker, also paid this Dallas guy thousands of dollars for an absentee ballot campaign. But wait, there is more. McCray Dallas, whose Get Out the Vote activities are at the center of the election fraud scandal in North Carolina, told a political campaign volunteer that he was holding on to 800 absentee ballots, according to a new affidavit obtained by NBC News. In the signed statement, Kenneth Simmons said that he met Dallas at a Republican Party meeting in the town of Dublin, which is in Bladen County. Simmons wrote that he and his wife saw Dallas with a large number of absentee ballots in, quote, in his possession. That's already illegal right there in North Carolina. Simmons stated that he asked Dowless why he had so many ballots, and Dowless responded that he was holding on to more than 800 of them. More than 800 of them. Simmons wrote that, remember, by the way, Harris reportedly won this election by just 905 votes. Simmons wrote that, quote, he asked him why he had not turned them in, and Dallas replied, quote, you don't do that until the last day because the opposition would know how many votes they had to make up. Simmons said, my concern was that these ballots were not going to be turned in at all. And who knows if they were. Simmons signed the affidavit Wednesday, December 11, and confirmed the account to NBC News when he was reached by phone. The Republican nominee in the 9th District, Mark Harris, won by more than 60% of Bladen County's mail-in ballots, which is a huge margin considering just 19% of accepted mail-in ballots actually belong to registered Republicans. We also previously detailed an unusually huge portion of absentee ballot requests by Democrats that reportedly never made it back to the county for some reason. In their own conference in rally on Tuesday, the leader of the Democratic Party in the state, Wayne Goodman, asked why Harris even decided to hire Dowless. He said McCrae Dowless has a long history of conducting absentee ballot fraud. That was well documented, yet Mark Harris still hired him, and now Harris refuses to answer several questions about their relationship.
The plot thickens.
Yes, it does. So to review very quickly what we've learned today on today's broadcast, Trump is probably cooked. Obamacare probably isn't, at least yet. And at a minimum, the 2018 midterm elections are not over, as there will almost certainly now be a new election of some sort in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. All of those stories, no doubt, continue on our next thrilling broadcast tomorrow, for which I hope you will join me and my producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you, Des. My thanks also to Alice Olstein of Politico and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And find, follow, and share everything that we do here on the Facebooks and the Twitters. You can find me there. I am The Brad Blog. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to make this show possible at all. Thank you. All right, that's it. Until we meet again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.